It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hi, it's Ken Bergen here from Hospo Reset. And today on the podcast, I'm talking to Liz Perkins from the Hospitality Company, and we're going to be talking on teaching chefs about kitchen management and menu design. Hey, Liz, great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
This is a topic that I'm passionate about. I'm not a chef, you are, but I've done a lot of training and coaching over the years, and the number side of it and the costing. I mean, ultimately, if we don't make money, we close the business or we can't employ the people who are in the kitchen. And we've got to get to the kind of the root of this. So we're going to talk about numbers and financial skills, but chefs have a much broader range of responsibilities around managing people and purchasing and a whole lot of things. And excited to hear about the course that you run, which is short, sharp and intensive, and how you've put that together and your thinking behind it. So, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I apologize for the accent. It can get a little bit intense, I'm sure, for Australians, but those with a Scottish
I think
or Irish
the people out of Australia
okay.
and New Zealand will both think that we're a couple of weirdos, won't they?
They will, yeah. Mine's quite southern and strong, so sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay, nice. So it starts with numbers, and you train people in kind of financial literacy or numeracy, whatever we want to call it. Why is this important for chefs and restaurant owners? Why do we need to kind of get right down to the basics immediately?
Well, I think the first thing, Ken, is to, and you've mentioned it, but to recognise that numeracy is not something that we've necessarily got as a talent as chefs. It's not something we probably didn't excel at school. It's probably part of the reason that we were attracted to something so practical like cookery is because it didn't have that academic element to it. So I think we have to acknowledge from the start that it's probably not a natural strength for most chefs, and that's a really broad sweeping term. I acknowledge there will be people out there that are comfortable with it. So I think it's first separating out financial numeracy and financial literacy. So numeracy is really that basic understanding of how numbers work. And as an owner or general manager, not making an assumption that just because you're comfortable with it, that other people should be too. So really having that true teaching heart that if somebody's struggling with numeracy, they're going to find this subject, a part of their role, very challenging. So getting to that place.
I like that term, your teaching heart. I love that, actually.
Yeah,
it's like really kind of identifying when there's a weakness and we need to reach out to that person and not make them wrong, but work to fix it.
Yeah. Well, we need to simplify it. We need to make it a way that's that old e-myth term, or it needs to be a repeatable process that makes money. And if it's something that people are struggling to get their heads around, we need to do a better job of turning that into a system that people can follow in a way that builds their confidence around numbers, not makes them feel. I often see people, Ken, who aren't comfortable with numbers, their first reaction is to become almost defensive or shut down. And I think that shouldn't be. I think we take that message that they're sending us quite wrongly. I think when people are sending you that message, when they're responding in that way, we have to look at that and go, okay, this person's uncomfortable because they're not understanding. And if we can get them to understand, there's a higher chance they'll be passionate about it.
And there's another issue sometimes pops up too, is people who can't read. And they're the ones who might say, oh, I left my glasses at home or something like that. And when I pick up on that, I've had a few interventions over time because it's actually free. Eye tests are free here. I'm sure they are in New Zealand. And glasses are cheap glasses don't cost much, but it's kind of like the excuses, what you're saying, will come forward first. We've got to recognise that's just the start of the conversation. Now that everyone's got one of these things, a mobile phone, which has a calculator, is that there's a tool there that's in everyone's pocket. Is that making it easier for people to sort of play around and get better with numbers? Or
I don't think so. I think that it's a tool, but you've got to have the knowledge to be able to work the tool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's... I mean, as a chef, I'm sure all the chefs listening to this have been in social situations where they've watched a domestic cook using a knife and cringed at the...
Yes, she's about to cut their fingers off.
Yeah, and so they've got the same tools as we have, but they don't have the knowledge. And so I don't think that has necessarily made life easier for people. I think some of the software out there is certainly making it much easier for people to understand, but your tools are only as good as your skills and knowledge, and so they support them, but they don't give you the base. So I think it's about making sure that we make it as simplistic as possible, and don't get lost in the weeds, don't get distracted by numbers that don't actually impact your
So what's a simple little exercise that you do? I guess I know your courses are online. Do you do live courses, or is it mostly just online?
Pre-COVID did a lot of live courses.
Yeah, okay. So you kind of, the morning one, everyone comes in, there's a bit of kind of anxiety in the room.
Yeah.
And how do you do your first number exercise? Because I'm thinking about if someone's got a couple of chefs they're sitting around a table with, what's a way to just break the ice with this?
I think the first thing to recognise is that probably over time it's been delivered more complicated than it needs to be. And if we really boil it down and stick to just the key areas that make a big difference to our business and don't overcomplicate it, it's the simple things done well that will make your business successful. And I think when we don't understand how to collect those numbers in an accurate and timely way, and we invest a lot of time and energy into collecting those numbers, and then we don't know what to do with them, we think we've collected the wrong numbers, and we think we've collected them inaccurately, and so we get frustrated. And so
Because the result we get is like a surprise to us, and thinking, oh my God, that can't be right. That's too much.
Yeah, we may have missed a piece. It may have taken us quite a long time to gather that information. And so it actually has become irrelevant. If you think about when we price a menu or price dishes, and then within weeks, those prices aren't accurate anymore. And so it's about making sure you've got software systems.
Yeah, exactly.
At the moment, it's horrendous. But making sure that we've got software that's keeping that up to date and accurate to the last invoice.
So your recommendation is a software-based approach.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm very comfortable with numbers, Ken. Just to give you a bit of background, I come from a strong numeracy background, but my father is a maths teacher. My sister's an accountant. My grandparents were maths teachers.
I come
from quite a sort. It is in my DNA. And just to put that, just to sort of soften that a little bit, I am quite dyslexic, so certainly not a natural gifted learner by any means. But I certainly feel much more comfortable with numbers than perhaps my counterparts have.
Yeah.
And so just recognizing that before I put software into my business, I had tried very hard to get together the right data, and I'm comfortable with spreadsheets, I'm comfortable with building them, I'm comfortable with the numbers, and I still couldn't pull it off successfully.
Right. Okay.
And so because every time I built something, it became clunky and hard to manage and hard to put things in. So,
and it's the updating, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It gets very laborious.
Yeah. So you need a software system that you do your ordering through, and your inwards goods comes into that, and that feeds directly into your recipes and onto your point of sale. That gives you that cost of goods relative to how much you're selling that item for. So that's live. So my hands down favorite piece of software in that space is one called Loaded, which is a New Zealand product. It's available in Australia. I don't work for them, but I am a raving fan.
Well, James, your colleague, who's also been on this podcast, is a big fan. And I've met Richard, who founder of the company. And it's pretty remarkable what can be done with that. And
I think the unique thing about Loaded is it's been built by hospitality professionals using IT experts to help them build it. And so it's not been built from an IT professional coming in, seeing an issue and trying to build it. It's been built from the other angle. And so it's quite sympathetic to our time restraints, our numeracy inabilities, the moving parts of a business, and how they need to integrate together. So that's why I'm a raving fan.
Right. Okay. So our chef, who's maybe started a new job and is a real gun on the stove and can pull the team together and just very productive person, but now is expected to be much more accountable for the numbers, which in the last job maybe was done by someone else or the boss or someone. What are some of the kind of documents and tools and things, loaded may be available, maybe not, or something like that, but there's documents and primary sources and things that they could be using.
Well, there's three major things that you're looking for with your information. So I'm a bit of an advocate for not collecting data unless you know what you're going to do with it at the outset. So not necessarily knowing the results, but knowing what the purpose of gathering that data is. So don't go stock taking if you don't have in place the ability to then review that stock taking and make positive change. So don't go collecting data that you've got no realistic ability to cover off. So if you're weekly stock taking your entire stock lines because somebody's told you that best practice is to stock take every week, but the pressure of even just pulling off that counting and putting those numbers into a system, whether it's loaded reports or your point of sale or just a spreadsheet, and then nothing happens, then the time you really have that is waste. That is a huge amount of time waste that you've done there. It'd be much better to have picked four items, stock take those every week, knowing that you have actually got a fighting chance of making some change around those
four
items.
High value protein items, maybe.
High value or high turnover. So don't underestimate something like if you're a gastro pub, I would absolutely be counting fries on a very regular basis. Because although it's not an overly expensive item, the volume of what you use means it has a major impact on the overall cost.
Yeah, and even a few grams out in the sort of portioning is going to be tens of kilos every week, isn't it?
And what I find is when people have collected really clean data that they can trust, then actually the solutions are very obvious, as chefs are actually very good at fighting fires and coming up with practical solutions to problems. The trouble is I certainly, in my experience, felt like there were so many problems to solve. I didn't know which ones to do first and no way of measuring how well I'd done it. And so it becomes the snowball effect of just feeling like you're in the weeds all the time.
Oh, my God, where do I start?
And doing something and feeling like it's worked but not actually having the data to support the fact that you have one when it came to that.
So we need good – we need clean data and organisation in our point of sale layout and design too. And our PLUs have to – have got – the open key is not allowed to be used. All those kind of things.
And then the second thing next to data is, of course, wastage, which is the monkey on all of our backs and kitchens. But again, it's accepting, and I think this is something that once people get into stock management, they get a bit of a bug for it, they get a wee bit excited, and then they start to feel quite disheartened when they're still getting wastage and they're still getting variations on their stock take reports. And recognizing that we can't expect zero variances. We can't expect zero waste in the kitchen. That's unrealistic. What we want is to be better than we were yesterday, and that's all we can hope for. So if you got in a side of porterhouse and you had 15% waste on that when you trimmed it, can we go for 14 or 13% next time? And just focusing on that for a week with your team, turning that into a repeatable process, into a discipline, into a habit.
Competing with ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so instead of going, if you're getting reports from your general managers currently that are saying your cost of goods are 34% and we want them to be 30%, to me, that's what I call a one-dimensional number. To me, that's a result, not a set of actions. I want to see how did we calculate that number? Because the factors that go into calculating the number, those are my levers. That's where I've got the leverage.
And there might be 20 or 30 different small levers which can all influence that.
So it's about just keeping it simple.
I love that idea of competing with ourselves from last week as well, because then and when it is like one cut of meat, everyone can feel like, hey, I can do this.
And then it just becomes you're refining your systems all the time so that those things become a habit and become discipline.
It also addresses that issue. And I heard it again. I was at a workshop with some restaurant people last week. And again, the question, you're waiting for it always, like, oh, what is an allowable amount? What is an okay percentage for waste? Well, it's actually zero.
But less than yesterday.
Yeah. But people really are looking for external standards or validation or kind of industry, acceptable industry numbers or whatever. And oftentimes that just doesn't exist, or it's not appropriate for your style of business.
And that's, I mean, that's where historic data can really support you with that. So if you can see that historically over the last 6 months, this is the trend of the wastage on this particular product, and for whatever reason in the last fortnight, it's spiked, then you need to ask yourself, well, what's been different in the last fortnight?
Let's go hunting.
We've hired a new chef. We've got a new supplier. Mm-hmm. That person's been off sick and we tasked that to somebody else. Like, where are your levers? And once you can refine that down and go, okay, that's the information that I'm looking at. That's what's been done differently. We need to revert back. Or often in kitchens, I think it's just that I think chefs are fundamentally quite generous people. And we tend to put our hearts and souls into our plates, regardless of what end of the market we're at. We struggle to not feed people more.
So it's a little bit of Nana and Grandpa in that, isn't it? A little bit of that coming out in a nice big plate and feed you up and all that stuff. Yeah.
And it's your self-esteem on that plate. Yeah. So that's why we tend to have such an emotional reaction when we get a negative comment back about our food, because we feel disappointed in ourselves.
We're caring for you.
Yeah. And so I think it's a matter of establishing that standard of this is what we agreed we would sell. And then having measures in place to even just checking yourself. The business that I owned for 15 years, you could tell whether or not I had been on shift or not, because the fries stocktake that I was talking about, whenever I'd been on shift, when the results were the worst.
Really?
Because I was absolutely the worst culprit at it.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. So what's number three? What's the third factor?
So the third thing is just making sure that everybody on your team has a part in that. So it's important that people understand why you're doing things. And again, going back to that, recognizing the nature of most people that work in the back of house and in hospitality in general, actually, is that we're kinesthetic learners, and kinesthetic means that we learn through doing. And so to be told what the results of your stocktake are as a commis chef or a kitchen hand or even a sous chef, just to be told what the results were doesn't give you an emotional connection to them.
Right.
So making sure that your system is that it's a team effort, that it's not a management task to collect the data, that everybody's involved in it. And so therefore you can have much more meaningful conversations. I definitely think that when people contribute to the collecting of the data and they contribute to putting it into your software system or your spreadsheet or however you're doing it, that they watch those numbers move and they see them react and then they get a feel for what's happening. Mm. And so if you just
feeding back to something that I know your company is passionate about is open book management.
Absolutely.
Too. That data is it's almost like you go into some financial offices and there's a big screen on the wall with all the numbers sort of changing as you watch them.
Yeah.
That would be the ideal thing, wouldn't it?
I know. And I know you've had James on talking about open book management, so I won't get stuck on that. I love that stuff. But, you know, there's a big difference. This is how I explain it to people, that there's open book reporting, which all of us in the industry would have been exposed to some level of, where we're being told what the numbers are and we're seeing the numbers.
Yeah.
And people might think, well, we are doing open book management because our business is transparent. But open book reporting and open book management are different. So open book reporting is sharing the numbers. Mm-hmm. Open book management is empowering people to be able to change those numbers in a positive way. And they have to know how they move, how they're influenced, what they can do about those numbers, really deeply understand how they're affected before they can do that. And so it's not just about showing people your numbers. It's about getting them involved in the entire process.
That's an important distinction, because you hear people say, oh, you know, I share my numbers with my staff, or I always share this or that and the other. But what you're saying is reminding us that's actually not enough if they can't actually do anything about it, because they're not actually going to stay interested very long.
No.
If all they can do is just look at it and it's every week, it's just as bad.
Well, this is a key thing to think about when you're testing that theory in your business is to think, am I showing them the result, or am I highlighting the actions. So if I say to you, Ken, this was your cost of goods for last month, it was 34%. You need to be able to say to me, well, what was the sales mix? How many of the profitable items did we sell? How many of the unprofitable items did we sell? What was the wastage? We want to know the action steps that contributed to that result.
Yeah, yeah.
And because those are the things we can change. I can't, if you say to me, I think I'm had a reasonable amount of experience when it comes to stock management, you'd hope, teaching these courses.
Yes.
But if you put me in a restaurant, Ken, and said, this restaurant has got a 34% cost of goods. Now, I know that's not a good enough number, but there are a lot of other things I would need to know before I could influence and positively change that business. Uh-huh. And so just telling your team the result without telling them how they got the result. You know, if you think about it's like a sports team. If I said to you, Ken, your rugby team lost by 10 points next week, I want that to not happen. You're going to need more information to know, well, how many tries were there? How many conversions were there? What was our defense like? Did anybody get injured? You
was
need
it
to 30 know.
To 20 or was it 10-0?
Exactly. So you need to know a lot more information. So one of the things I try and encourage people to think about with their numbers and challenge themselves on is only report on numbers where you've got cause and effect. So only report on a number that has other numbers to tell its story. So we don't just want to report on, for example, really easy one for people to get their heads around. We don't just want to report on what our weekly sales were. If you tell me this is the turnover of this business, I would want to know, well, what is the average transaction and how many customers? So I don't just want to know the turnover or the sales figure at the top. I want to know, well, what is that made up of? Are you a high turnover, like high customer, low spend per head, like a counter cafe? Or are you a high spend per head, low customer number, like a fine dining restaurant? I need to know what those, what made up that number. And so if you were to say to me, this is our wage cost percentage, I want to know a lot about that as well. So you don't ever just present one dimensional
We want to know at least minimum back of our house, front of house for our wage costs.
And I want to know, was that turnover the expected turnover for that week? Was it, if you got a particularly low wage cost, did you have extra functions that came in? Were you short-staffed? I want to know what contributed to that number.
Were there floods and storms?
Was it a normal turnover week?
Yeah.
Or was there other factors in there?
Yeah.
What is the information that made up that number?
Now, I am loving this, and I realise we've dived into the minutia, and I haven't actually asked you to tell us a little bit about your background, because I know you're a chef, and I know your dad was taught mathematics. So.
Yeah.
But what brought you to the teaching, well, into HOSPO and the teaching of it and all those things? Tell us.
Well, I think probably that teaching heart's always been there, like we talked about before, having come from an education family. So I've always worked in hospitality. I've never worked in any other profession. I've worked in all parts of hospitality, but I began on a gap year from high school. I was meant to go to teacher's college. Didn't really like the idea of that. So stayed in hospitality in my summer job and did that for a couple of years. So mostly in Queenstown in Surfers Paradise. I lived on the Gold Coast for a while and decided that I actually...
Both for those not in Australia and New Zealand, peak tourist towns, aren't they?
Peak tourist towns, But with that small village kind of feel, I suppose they have.
Yeah.
So I came back to New Zealand after living in Australia and thought, I'm serious about this. I want to make this my career. I felt, I guess, because of the perception of chefs that the back of house lifestyle was more prestigious, perhaps, than front of house. So I went off to your version, a TAFE, our version, a Polytech in Invercargill in my hometown, and did a 2-year diploma in hospitality management, which included doing your chefing papers in there.
Right.
And then I had a variety of jobs coming out of there, operations managers for multi-site venues, some cookery jobs, but mostly my professional experience up to 25 was predominantly front of house and management with some cookery. And then I, through all my 25-year-old wisdom, bought a restaurant in central Otago.
I can do anything. I can
I know everything. And so I live in central Otago, which is the town I live in, is about an hour inland from Queenstown. So still very much tourism, although more domestic than international as Queenstown is. So bought a restaurant here at 25. Was reasonably average at that for 2 years. decided the answer to all of my problems was to turn it into more of a beverage focused business. That was the extent of my knowledge, that if I sold more beer, then I would make more money. So I went into a relationship with DB Breweries, became a one of their brands here in New Zealand is Monteith's, and became a Monteith's branded bar. Did that for another 7 years and worked pretty hard. There was a lot of sweat went into there. I was working 60 hours a week as a chef and trying to run the business on top of that. And I remember having this very clear moment. Where we live here in central Otago, it gets very cold in the winter, so quite dry weather, but we can get minus 10s. And sitting in my office in the back of the kitchen one day, feeling quite low about the weather and the my finances, I'd not long got my end of year financial report from the accountant, and we'd made $1,500 the year before.
Wow.
And it was fairly heartbreaking, and I thought, I've tried everything I know. That's all the tricks I've got. I don't know what to do next. I knew that there was a trend formulating or starting to become more common of database management, of sending, running a database and having a much more involved loyalty program. And I had that seed of a thought. And so I went looking for some help, just started Googling for some help and came across a webinar that my colleague James O'Connell was running on database management. And I learned more in that hour than I had learned in 10 years.
Wow.
And being a reasonably competitive person, he said the fastest typical sales thing, but the fastest people to email me, I've got a few free spots for a free coaching session. First to respond, blah, blah, blah. So
20 seconds later, yeah, your email was off.
I'm pretty competitive. So. And so had an hour conversation with James and just blown away by how complicated I had made my business.
Interesting. How complicated, right. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was my overwhelming.
So you couldn't actually see what was going wrong? Or
no. Well, I just was spending so much time running the complication that I didn't have any time to fix anything. So like we had a lot of great financial systems in place and a lot that I still teach and use today with clients. It's just the numbers going into them were no good. And I didn't know what to do about them. So
you were like you said earlier on, you were measuring things that with no cause and effect, just for the sake of measuring them,
and no, absolutely no realistic ability to be able to find the time or energy to change them. There's just no way, because we didn't have any leadership systems or communications. We didn't have anything else to be able to deliver on change. And so I started getting coached by James. I couldn't afford him, and so I had an attitude of he will only teach me everything once and I will do it. So
and then I'll say goodbye.
Yeah, that was the plan. I thought I'd get him for 3 months and I had him for 4 years. So.
Yeah, awesome. Well,
but by then I could afford him. So we went from a $1,500 net operating profit to 4 years later having $270,000 net operating profit. And to put that in perspective, I live in a town with 5,000 people. So we went from a turnover of about 900,000, which I thought was pretty flash because we'd bought the business when it was 500,000. So I thought I was doing okay at 900 and got it to 1.6 just before we sold it nearly three years ago. So really learnt the hard way how painful it can be to be an owner operator who's trying to work in and on your business. But nothing would have prepared me for my own ability to grow and change and learn. I really didn't realize the ability to learn that I had.
That's a nice way to put it. Yeah, you sort of recognize how you were only kind of using 50% of your own ability.
I think that that was probably the thing. When people ask me what was the biggest change that you made in your business to make it successful, it was me. I was the biggest change. I was the biggest problem, and I was the biggest change. So it was realizing that I had stopped learning and I stopped growing and that I was trying to do it all by myself and I wasn't surrounding myself with smart enough people. And I think a lot of business owners would tell you the same when they've moved from failure to success.
We hear this word mindset a bit and sometimes kind of think, what do you mean by that? But I mean, what you're talking about is a change of mindset too.
Yeah.
My feeling is that the work you do with your clients, whether they're chefs or business owners, whatever, that's a pretty integral part. Talk to us about mindset and how you help people change that.
I think that that's the thing that our industry has done historically very badly is it has celebrated ego. And there is really no way to learn if you've got ego as your skin. So the only real way to learn anything is to be humble and to be open. Now, that doesn't mean you need to accept things blindly. You should be intelligent about what the information that you're taking on, and you should squeeze it and shake it and pull it before you're ready to put it into your business. But if you are too proud and too arrogant and have too much ego, then there's no ability to absorb new information. And I think that, hopefully James agrees with me, I think that's the thing that I went in with the right mindset, that I've tried everything I know and it hasn't worked. I'm going to do what James tells me to do until he makes a mistake.
So you were coming along with maybe a degree of desperation.
Oh, absolutely,
but also,
desperate.
Also an open mind and prepared to say, well, actually, I need some wise advice here.
Well, I knew I had two choices. I could sell it, and I was just literally, Ken, too embarrassed to show people my accounts.
Yeah.
Because the perception on the outside was we were quite successful.
Yes, you were busy.
Yeah, we were busy. We were definitely the biggest business in town, small town, but biggest business in town, supported by a big New Zealand brewery. Yeah, a definitely young. The perception was that I'd done all of this quite young. Everybody
they just they must have wondered why you weren't going overseas on holidays all the time.
Yeah, my 10-year-old Toyota Corolla. I don't know why they thought I was a millionaire, but they did. So I think that we celebrate ego in our industry, and I think that's to our detriment. I think that I know as a chef, when you are in that moment in the kitchen and the printer is just going nuts, printing off dockets, and you've got them lined up in front of you, you've got a brigade of people to communicate with, you can't actually have a seed of self-doubt in that moment. Like, you'd freeze up. You actually do have to look at that line of dockets inside your head, be saying, I've got this. I'm the shiz. I can pull this off. And I am really good at this. And
so you have managing service, peak service. And then if we take that to 7 days a week, it's really, you've got to have that same mindset. I've got this.
Yeah.
Because we're not just managing pans on the stove. We've got 20 staff and all of their ins and outs and
absolutely
the thousand customers and
you can't afford to let that seed of doubt and feel flustered and so, but it's recognizing that that can stay in service, that confidence and arrogance are two different things.
So we need the mindset development you're talking about. We need to develop more resilience and more kind of strength. It's not muscle.
We need
strength,
to have
it's a bit like that, I suppose.
Mindset. There's this great book called Mindset, actually written by a woman called Carol Dweck. Have you read that that book?
No,
Ken?
No.
Great book.
I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah, it's called Mindset.
Carol Dweck. Dwink.
Dweck. Carol Dweck. She's an American psychologist, and she wrote a book called Mindset. And in it, she defines those two mindsets as being a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. So somebody with a fixed mindset would say, I can't do that. Somebody with a growth mindset would say, I can't do that yet. And that's the essence of it. So we want to have a growth mindset and be able to say, I can't do that yet. What do I need to be able to change that?
Okay, that feels kind and manageable, actually.
Yeah,
in that way.
Well, she uses it to teach children, so she teaches educators. Okay. So it's a great tool. I think one of the things that's missing from the management conversation is that managers, great, successful, long term successful managers, are essentially fantastic teachers. They're great
coaches,
cheerleaders,
committed. Yeah, and committed to their own learning. They never stop learning either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because if you are a practice learner, it is very easy to be a practice teacher. If you remember and you're absorbed in the learning process yourself, it becomes a lot easier to take that into your teaching. And I think that's something that needs to happen with numeracy. If we can turn it into a set of tools with financial numeracy and then on to financial literacy, and that those become a set of tools that we're immersed in, then we have the abilities not just to be good at it ourselves, but to be able to teach other people coming into our industry who also probably haven't had great academic success with numbers.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, I want to go on to talk about teamwork and managing teams, which is an important part of what you teach. But before we do that, just on menu design, menu engineering, all these terms, just Talk to us a bit about how you teach that and what are the kind of the important things that people need to learn or unlearn around menus.
Yeah, I sort of teach it in a maybe a little bit of what will come across as a little bit of an abstract way, but I think if you study business, it's very logical. And so I think what happened, certainly happened in my career and watching other chefs develop and what they develop on their menus, is we tend to put on things that we're perhaps passionate about or that we see as being trends. And the reality is there's only very few restaurants in the restaurants and cafes in the hospitality sector that that need to lead the way in terms of those trends. And so what we need to recognize is that we are a business, and a business sells products for a profit to the people that want those products. And so the first thing we need to do is recognize who are our customers, what do they want from us, and then how can we produce something for them that's going to make money and fulfill that need and that want. And so first, instead of designing a menu, first going, okay, who are our key customers? So using the 80-20 rule, so 80% of our customer, 80% of our sales are coming from 20% of our customers. So don't, again, filtering it down to the basics. We don't want to be measuring and monitoring and analyzing all of our customers, just the 20% that are our base or our raving fans. What do our raving fans want from us? And are we providing that? And so using that as the backbone of what your customers...
They're raving fans, and what do they actually rave about?
Yeah, what is it that they want to stay in your wheelhouse? Yeah. What is it that you're good at? What is it that they need from you? What problem are you solving for them? Do they need a fast coffee on their way to work? Are they looking to spend a long Friday night with their girlfriends? What is it that... What lifestyle problem are you solving for them? And be very clear about that. And then build your menu from there. So what price point are they at? What product do they want? What occasion are they using you for? And then let your menu answer those questions. And then making sure that we're paying attention to what I call the sales mix. So the items that are profitable, making sure that we're doing what we can to promote them, because the more of those that we sell, the lower our cost of goods will be. Making sure that there are a few items, we call them workhorses at the hospitality company. Those are items that cost us a lot to produce, but we sell a lot of them. So if you are a cafe, it would be coffee. So you sell a lot of coffee, it's expensive, not just from a cost of goods point of view, but from a labor point of view. And it's particularly sensitive to quality and waste. So it's definitely a workhorse. Now, we can't get rid of that. That can't leave our business. And we're a little bit restricted in the market to how much we can charge for it. So that's where we would want to focus our day-to-day cost of goods management. That's where we want to be really careful with portion control and wastage.
Right. So I'm guessing chips might be part like this as well, chips. In certain, like a pub or...
Chips potentially would be what we call a star. So a star is something that we sell a lot of, but are as a low cost of goods.
Okay.
And so we want to be looking at, like, if we were talking about a gastro pub such as I had, it would have been tap beer. Tap beer was the one that high waste, limited ability in the market to be able to price it where you want to. You're a little bit restricted by what the rest of the market is doing. And it's a reasonably perishable product. So it's got potential to blow out if you're not looking after it. Or if you're a fine dining restaurant or any sort of a la carte style, it would be house pour wine or glass pour wine. Would be something you'd be wanting to watch. And so instead of trying to expect our team to measure the waste and the movement of 20 different lines every day, let's just focus on the one that makes the biggest difference. And by nature, Ken, the more disciplined we are about those little things, that discipline flows into the rest of our lives. And so we tend to become more disciplined with everything else in the business as well, not just the cost of goods.
Yeah, it's interesting that the stars and workhorses and dogs and the other one, puzzles. It's been a kind of classic explanation for menu engineering, and it just works. So it let's learn it, and let's not just kind of try any other smart alternatives. Damn well works, and apply it to our own business.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, thinking back to some training I used to run as well, when people actually apply it to their own business and write the symbols beside it, it's just like the lights come on, don't they?
Yeah, really? They really do.
And people realize, oh my God, look, that really high profit item that we turn our nose up and think
it's not cool enough good for, that. For us. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and we need a balance of all of those. So we want to be looking for dogs all the time. So that's why we want that live feed of our inwards low goods profit, coming low in the sales, time. Yeah, losers, so yeah. Low profit, low sales. I often find that we have them on for emotional reasons. So they may have been a great seller in the past. They might be one of our really favourite guests, loves it, and we don't want to offend them by getting rid of it.
Yes, we are. You know? We're at the effect of those people.
Yeah, it is often.
But data can sometimes prove, if you actually pull up the sales, people say, oh, yeah, but there's a few people like it. You pull the sales up, but there's actually one. We made one sale last week.
Yeah, absolutely. And often I have them say, oh, yes, but we're using products from other dishes and so there's never – it's not really a hassle to have it. Uh-huh. And I think it's cluttering your menu.
Yes.
One of the things that I think we need to get our heads around a little bit in hospitality is that most people are coming out to lessen the stress on their lives. They're looking for a soft place to land. That coming into a hospitality venue is time out from the rest of their life, whether it's busy family life or work life or whatever it is. Most of them are coming for a breath of – to take a breath, right? And they don't need to be bombarded with a whole lot of decisions. Mm. And so we tend to put too many things on our menus. Mm-hmm. We would be much better to be smarter
about
it.
Sounds like you take the knife to menus if you're asked. Well,
I had to take the knife to my own, so it was a little bit – I mean, I'm absolutely holding a mirror to myself when I say this stuff. This is how I behaved for years. Yeah. Putting things on a menu was never a problem. Taking things off, brutal. So that's where I just let data be the decision maker.
Nice. Mm. Let's talk about team, leading teams, being in charge of teams, choosing new people, recruitment, your retention, some pretty hot topics
Big subjects there,
We've got some time, but not what do you teach and what do you find are the kind of the toughest things for people to learn or habits to unlearn and new ones to learn?
I think the biggest problem, we've talked about it a little bit already with kitchens, is that historic perception of how we're supposed to behave as kitchen leaders.
Right.
And that not a fan at all, but that Gordon Ramsay type mentality of tough love. And I just, it's not the modern way forward. There is nothing in any of the data that's collected on employment satisfaction around the world generationally that would suggest that's what anybody wants from their workplace. It doesn't produce great people, and I think that historically it's the reason that we're in the deficit in hospitality that we are now with chefs.
I totally agree. Yeah.
We're breaking good people, and we're celebrating the fact that we're doing it.
Yeah. Mm. We burn our young. We eat our young.
Yeah. And we say things like, well, they weren't destined for here. They wouldn't cope. I mean, I'm very grateful that I had my start front of house. I don't know that it would have lasted, Ken, if I had started and stayed in kitchens. Mm. I'd had a few kitchen hand jobs in the early days, and I found kitchens quite brutal. And I think that I had a lot to offer a kitchen. I think that would potentially have gone to waste and gone to another industry had I not had the better start I had by being out front of house. And so I think that we have to acknowledge that system is broken and it's cruel. In some countries, particularly in New Zealand, with our employment law, illegal. So we need to be addressing our own attitudes towards developing people and realizing what it is that people want from their employment. So we don't have to make that up and we don't have to try and discover that ourselves. There's some great research out there. One of my favorites is Gallup, an American company that collects research on employment, and they have written some fantastic books. A really great one called First Break All the Rules, followed up by one they wrote just released last year post-pandemic called Wellbeing at Work. In their First Break All the Rules, what they did was a massive piece of work researching about 800,000 employees. And the number one thing that came out of that people want from their workplace is clearly defined expectations. And I think when we recognize as kitchen managers that actually most of the time we've had to tell somebody off for not doing their jobs well, if we held a mirror up to that, we would recognize that we didn't give them great instructions.
They didn't actually know what good was.
Yeah, they didn't know what good was. And so I'm quite one of the things I teach, Ken, and I'm quite passionate about is communication. And so recognizing that George Bernard Shaw quote of just because the biggest misconception in communication is that it took place. And so recognizing that just because we said it didn't mean they heard it and didn't mean they understood it.
Yeah.
And so again, coming back to that, are you a teacher or are you a manager? And so a teacher or a leader makes sure that the person has received the communication in their style of communication, not in yours.
Mm. And once there's a sort of robust, believable, accurate data, much more of it, and it's looked at and talked at and pulled apart and everything like that, there's actually more interesting things to talk about in a way, aren't there? Because, like, you know, people do know what good, how we measure good. We have numbers because a month ago and the month before and everything like that. It's, yeah, we've still got to train people and show people how to do the work. But the measurement is a much fairer conversation then.
Yeah.
Rather than just you haven't got what it takes or you've got a bad attitude. Or
and I think going back again to that as a head chef or a kitchen manager, if you were teaching one of your juniors how to make a certain dish, you wouldn't teach them it by showing them the completed plate. Mm. And so likewise with the other moving parts of your business, your all of your systems, your cost of goods systems, your wastage systems, your sales system, everything. Don't just show them the end result. Show them how you got there and let them play with that themselves. So if I were to teach you, Ken, how to make a chicken burger, and an element of that chicken burger is garlic aioli, I'm not going to show you a bottle of garlic aioli and say, this is how you make garlic aioli.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to show you the steps it took to do that. And so that same process needs to happen when we're teaching the other elements of our business. And so I think if you are a kitchen manager and you don't have a passion for teaching people and you find that part really unmotivating, then I would question whether or not you're in the right position, because kitchen management, kitchen leadership is essentially the ability to grow your team's knowledge.
Mm.
And that you can only do that by teaching them. So
yeah, not fastest gun on the pans.
Well, that's an element of it. It's an element, but it's only one part of it. It's not all of it. Mm. It's an important part. Like I'm not downplaying the importance of being great technicians. But they talk a lot in business, a really modern way of thinking about it at the moment is making sure that people understand the why. And when you're a kinesthetic learner, you don't comprehend the why by being told. You comprehend the why by doing it and practicing it.
Holding it and weighing it and prodding it and poking it. Yeah, yeah, that's a great – this, again, the – what is it, visual, auditory, kinesthetic, the three kind of patterns, and I'm very much a visual one, but so good to be reminded of that. We've had these kind of explanations available for many years. Yeah. It's just we were too busy to kind of
– we didn't think they applied to us. Principles. I think we thought they applied to high school and we didn't like it then.
Yeah,
so why
or finance or finance companies, tall office blocks or something like that. Liz, with the shortages of staff and the a bit sick of this great resignation, I think people are just kind of being much more wise about what jobs they go into. Mm. How are you seeing people, the smart operators, changing their recruitment or improving their staff management to address this?
I think the thing that we have to recognise, it's a little bit of it's the same mentality as I talked about designing your menu, is recognizing what it is that your market wants from you. And so putting your marketing hat on when you're thinking about your attraction campaign. So thinking about if we want to attract great people to our business, we need to first think, what does a great person look like and where are they? I think that there's very few fantastic employees that you will find are active job hunters.
They're not walking the street with their CV.
They've got a job already. And they're not natural. Like you talk about the mindset, the growth and fixed mindset. Really great employees will have a growth mindset, which means they've got fundamentally a positive attitude. And so they'll be in a current workplace not feeling actively dissatisfied. They're probably not hating their job. They're probably quite happy with their job. But if they can see something that's a bigger opportunity, a better opportunity, a more nurturing culture, a better opportunity to learn and grow, that's what they'll go there for. We need to recognize that people don't work in hospitality for the good hours or for the money. So don't lead your attraction campaign with we've got more money and we've got better hours, because that's fundamentally, we've accepted that that's part of what happens in hospitality is, we want it to be a competitive wage. We definitely don't want to be taken advantage of. And you definitely want some flexibility in our work-life balance, but most of us have accepted that we will be working in the weekends or at night, and that trying to attract people to not work in those periods isn't going to get you the people that you want or you need. And so recognizing that, why do we work in hospitality? Try and remember why you work in hospitality. Like, I do it because I love people. I love I get energy from other people, and I like making people feel good. I love making people feel satisfied, going beyond their expectations, making that experience more for them than they had expected. And so if that's what you're passionate about and those are the people that you want to attract to your business, offer them a platform for that. So if the internal culture and the culture of the business that attracts a certain type of customer that these people are going to be spending most of their time with, that's what you should be using to attract people to your business, not a bullet-pointed list of things
and
to do.
And publicising it better too. I look at so many restaurant websites, and I always look at the About Us and the employment pages, and they're usually these dreary, there's no photo, there's just no, and this is a good place. But it's just like, well, how else do I find it? If I'm lucky, I might have heard from a friend who worked there, but that's pretty rare.
Yeah. So some of the good ones that I like is definitely using your database. So your raving fans, they will recommend and pass on your attraction campaign.
Right.
And what better way to have a recommendation than from the people that they're going to be looking after. Internally with your own staff, of course, because most of us only want to work with other great people. Yeah.
Are you a fan of incentive, like
absolutely.
Bonuses?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's
what's a typical bonus that you would recommend, say, for a cafe that's affordable but might get good results?
I think anywhere between, and I really only know the New Zealand market, but anything between $50 and $300, and that would be tagged with how long they were there for.
Yeah.
So if you had a successful, let's say they got through their first 2 weeks, that would be $50, but perhaps if they got through their 90 days, it's $300. So it's definitely tagged to the longevity of that employee. I think that's really, almost, to me as a business owner, I think of it as almost an insurance policy by paying that money to your team. One, it's acknowledging that I think the very basis of an employer-employee relationship is you work, I pay you. And so if we're asking them to do some work for us by recruiting, then we should absolutely pay for that. That's the very base of the relationship.
Yep. Yeah.
And I'm not a fan of, like, as a side, I'm not a fan of expecting them to do homework. I'm not a fan of them doing work they're not paid for. I just, that is the very base of the relationship. You time for money. Yeah. And so I think that should never be ignored by a business owner. And again, they're not going to recommend just anybody for that kind of money. It's not enough money for them to recommend somebody who they don't want to work with.
We have a lot of traditionally in Australia had a lot of people from overseas who come for working holidays or study part-time, etc. And suddenly they all disappeared. Hundreds of thousands of people disappeared. So that's part of the problem. But also I think there's often something very lazy, almost racist about the way often overseas workers are treated as just kind of cheap labour, and they don't quite know how the rules are here, so we won't tell them, etc., etc. Yeah, it's not... I don't know. I hope the people are kind of coming to their senses a bit more.
Yeah, the New Zealand employment law protects people against that too. It's been tidied up a lot here. So we had a minimum wage, and you must have a contract. And so there's really no way. Well, I'm sure there's people that are doing it, but it's not commonplace anymore. But I think too that certainly in my time years ago now, but in my time working in Queenstown with a lot of transient workers coming through, is that they did tend to have quite large international networks. And so they themselves can feed into, I'm leaving, but my friend is coming. And you can really do kind of can get into this sort of network of people where you are recruiting from your superstars, you're recruiting other superstars.
Like a slowly spinning flywheel almost, constantly attracting.
That has been a problem for the New Zealand market too. But I think it's more of a generational issue that hospitality has become unattractive to young people because they don't want to be treated badly. And we've got a reputation of doing that.
Young leaders, the chef who's suddenly you're in charge, mate, and you're 23, what are some of the ways you help them be more successful and take on that role?
Well, the thing about young managers, I started managing my first restaurant management position, I was 19. And the thing about young managers is they tend to still have a very strong growth mindset. And their ability, their ability to learn, like their actual skill at learning, is still very fresh from school, whether they were good at it or not. Yeah,
that muscle hasn't decayed.
So they have got that very much that attitude of, I don't know all of the tricks and I'm really happy to learn. So I think of them as they're like an unwritten book as an owner. You set them on the right learning path with some great.
Point out some great online courses and things.
Get them a coach, get them a mentor. Those are the ones that I find really joyful to teach because they're so and huge energy. Like their ability to do a full day's work and then participate in a course that at the other end of our careers find that a wee bit exhausting. But, I have to do a course first thing in the morning or it's no good. So I think that young managers, given the right support, I think that definitely setting them up with a mentor, whether that's somebody that you're paying professionally to be in that role or somebody else, if possible, not somebody in hospitality, because I think we can learn a lot from other industries. And so if you can get somebody that's retail or marketing or HR or somebody from another industry, that just means that we're not repeating those same mistakes. Because I think that there needs to be a bit of a shift in the way that we nurture our people through hospitality.
The mentor thing is certainly being talked about a lot more. I think a lot of people are still waiting to work out how to do it and what it is and internal, external and all the rest. But at least it's a term that's become more common now.
Yeah, and things like our company, anybody that's a customer of our company, whether or not they're a one-on-one coaching client or they've bought a course, they're part of our hospitality company community page, Facebook page. And even just that network of people that are thinking the same.
Ask questions from your peers.
Yeah, they're not complaining about the state of the industry that you get on those more public pages. This is a group of people with the same mindset, on the same path, with the same growth outlook. That are communicating solutions, not problems.
Yes.
And so getting your young people into communities like that where you're surrounding them with smarter people. Don't surround them with lots of people. Be really smart about who you surround them with.
Nice. Wow. Wow, I am loving this conversation, Liz. I'd actually like to just keep going, but I'm going to sort of wrap up now because you've given me so many fresh things to think about. You've also reminded me things that I kind of knew and forgot that are just so fundamental. And, I love your passion and your kind of your teaching heart. You mentioned that term and I love that. Tell us how people can contact you, how they can do, and just tell us first of all about the online course, the kitchen management course you teach. I guess wherever you are in the world, you're happy to take people on. People find out? Yeah.
So probably the easiest way is to go to our website, thehospitalitycompany.co, and you can go in there and you can see our courses. We have different level courses. So there is the kitchen management course, which is specific to kitchen management, obviously. There's also another one in there that's on a similar subject called the financial control systems course, which was built for owners and managers. So definitely a great idea if you're putting some of your chefs onto the kitchen management course that you're making sure that you've got all of your bases covered, ready to support them. By doing something like that.
Right, that's the one the boss should do you're really backing them up.
Well, the kitchen manager's going to come to you after doing that course and say, these are the things that we need to have had sorted out. Where's this information?
Where is it?
So give yourself a bit of a head start. The financial control systems course isn't for frontline staff. It's definitely a manager, owner, whoever is the financial controller and can make those decisions around foundational setups around systems and financial reporting. So it's for that higher level. And I'm in the middle at the moment, or should be finished by the end of this week. Now that I've said it out loud, I have to. Financial Literacy 101 course, which is for frontline staff. We'll have the three tiers going on in there. And they can buy those direct from the website, or if you prefer to connect with a human being and discuss it, then you can fill out the online form on that website, and Isabel, who's our community builder, will be in touch mm-hmm. with you and walk you through how best to do it. So we try and make it as easy as possible to support you through it. Our courses yeah. are all run online through a system called Coach Accountable that holds it all there and walks you through it. And Isabel's there in the background ready to make sure that if you even struggle with online learning, she's there to help you through that. And of course, James and I are always available on the other end of an email or a quick phone call. So I just think that if enough of us move to make this industry more palatable, then we might just have a chance of getting and attracting some rock stars back into it.
You make me feel optimistic, and I'm sure people listening will as well. Thank you so much. It's
been You're welcome.
You're really wonderful.
Yeah. You're welcome. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the HospoReset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.